evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the second night on Limehawk. As you guys have heard so many times before, thousands of times, it's a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about the use and understanding of wireless equipment. So we teach each other how transmitters and antennas and transmission lines and receivers and digital hardware and propagation, how all this stuff works. The TechNet is broken up roughly into three sections. The first section is people signing in because they do have a question or an answer, a question or a comment to make. They sign in order, and you need not sign in just because you're listening. After 36 years almost, it will be this month, September 1982 is when the TechNet began. So 36 years ago. By now, we believe somebody is listening, so that doesn't have to be proven. The second section of the TechNet is the Science Talk section by Roy AC2GS, and he's got a good listing, a good set of interesting subjects to discuss tonight. And he will not be here next week because of the holiday. The third section is Paul WS2N giving us a space report. What's the latest with NASA and all the other space agencies? So we're going to go to the first section now. People will sign in because they do have a question or a comment. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. And do wait for the four beeps in between each transmission. K2IW listening for check-ins right now.
KD2AMZ, Mike, yes.
N2HVR, Nick, yes.
W2MST, Mark, yes.
Repeater, timeout.
Hey, no.
Okay, so we've got Mike, Nick, and Mark in that order. Anyone else to sign in because you do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now after the four beeps.
W8-4-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
Okay, we got Joe. One of the first times he signed in as late as that. He's normally the one of the first to sign in. One last call. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
And have the feedback. KJJ. Yes, actually, it's a question for Joe.
Now, do you have a point of order? Should we go with you right now, Eric, or do you want me to put you on the list? Over to you, Eric.
No, I'm just curious whether Joe did any DVD exiting at all this week, and if he did, what did he find? But I can wait.
Okay. Mike, KD2AMZ, you're number one on the runway. Go right ahead, Mike.
Well, good evening, Nick. Good evening, Nick. It's kind of a two-part comment and question. Comment first, regarding use of Waze navigation system on your when you're in a car versus a GPS unit. The other day, I ran into a problem with my daughter when I went to a funeral down in Pennsylvania where we either lost signal or the Waze servers died, and the application for navigation purposes was totally useless. The only thing that would have worked was a old-fashioned GPS unit such as a Garmin. So kind of be careful that that happens. If anybody else wants to comment on how Waze works, my server timed out and we were stuck, and then we figured out how to get to where we go to. I'm going to let the reset. Now for my question, this is regarding Brandmeister and Seabridge DMR. First off, what is the difference between Seabridge and Brandmeister? And the use of hotspots, my understanding, hotspots work with Brandmeister, but not necessarily with Seabridge, and how they all fall together. Those are my questions and comments, Dick. Back to Ned.
I can answer both of them.
I was about to pass it to you, Eric.
Alright. As far as Waze goes, Waze is a GPS inside the cell radio. The cell phone that you're using. But if you don't have data connectivity, you might have voice connectivity. Where there's, let's say, there's no cell site around, And if you were, say, listening to a streaming service like Pandora, you would see it's a buffering, because it's waiting. Waze uses the GPS within the cell phone, but the map itself and the directions are actually transferred via the data in real time. Your car moves, the GPS reports back to the Waze server. The Waze server, in turn, reports back the position that the map should be displayed. You got no cell service, you got no Waze. Simple as that. Part one. You okay with that, Mike?
Oh, absolutely, Eric. That's exactly what I suspect, and I was trying to explain to my daughter that Waze, it has a, if you don't have data connectivity, it's basically useless. You know, old-fashioned GPS or even a map was far superior in such a situation. Please continue, Eric.
All right, by the way, if you have an Apple or an Android, there are programs out there that preloads a map and actually works directly from the GPS. Doesn't communicate with anything. You just load a map with a particular area, and it works for that area. If you go outside that area, you don't have any cell service, you're not going to upload a map. That's one thing. Okay. Now, the other question. Mind me again?
Yes, Eric. I was toying with the idea of DMR hotspots, and I want to understand the difference between Brandmeister Network, Seabridge, and how they interrelate and how I can use, let's say, Talk Group 310, which is available on Seabridge, but is it available on Brandmeister, and how does Brandmeister work as comparison to Seabridge? So what's the difference between Brandmeister and Seabridge? And how does it all come together?
All right, let me correct you about something. What you're calling Seabridge is not a network. Seabridge is a piece of hardware. It is a server. It's a piece of software, actually, that runs on a server. The Seabridge actually is used by DMR MOF. The DMR MOF network is what you're talking about. We use DMR MOF. That is a group of people, actually it started out being a group of Motorola guys out of Illinois that created, what they did was they extended the IPSC or the IP secure connections between repeaters into the system that you now know as DMR-MOF, okay. Brandmeister is a different organization, different people, different group of networks, different servers, different kind of software. So right there. You've got two different things going on. And at the moment, it seems that Brandmeister has been asking DMR MOF to do things according to an agreement that was made a long time ago, which basically is about ID numbers and following the ESCI recommendations, which Brandmeister is doing. And DMR did at one point, but now they're starting to issue the first three digits of something else. And DMR, Brandmeister's getting kind of upset, whereas that they are now no longer going to pass any traffic from a improperly ID station. And let me let it drop, and I'll give you an explanation. Okay, sorry about that. The way the DMR is set up is that the IDs are... you'll notice that there's a lot of 3-1-somethings, or 313. That's for the United States. And that's the actual prefix that has been designated by ESCI a long time ago. DMR is now issuing IDs that start with 111, which is a European country code. So, DMR Mark is not communicating with Brandmeister. Brandmeister's getting a little upset. Anybody that's got a 111 ID that tries to get on Brandmeister that's originating from within the United States is not going to make it into their system. So, DMR Mark is one system. Brandmeister is another system. Brandmeister is a codec agnostic, a format agnostic service, meaning that it'll carry data from DMR, it'll carry data from NXDN, it'll carry data from P25, it'll carry data from Yaesu, and it'll also carry data from DSTAR. that's why the hotspot that you get, that you hook up to Bradmeister, can make that interconnection into these other networks. KD2MZ, any comments, KD2MZ?
Thank you there, Eric. You're explaining things. I have to do a lot of homework on this. That's given me a direction to start in, but thank you very much. Yeah, you're answering my questions, and I do appreciate it. And you're giving me a starting point because I obviously need to do more homework. I was pretty good with the DMR, and you're right, DMR Mark. I'm sorry, I made a mistake there. But now I want to understand Bradmeister a little bit better, so I have to do my homework. But you're sending me in the right direction, and I want to thank you, Eric.
All right, if you go to the Bradmeister website, good luck. It's not as intuitive, say, as DMR Mark stuff. Well, actually, you're connected to Bronx Turbo here. That's really well laid out, and the control panel that you see is very efficient. Bradmeister, because it is so worldwide, it's so cluttered, you got to know where you're going, otherwise you're not getting there. There are some explanations. Their website is a little iffy, let's put it nicely, but you may find that a little bit difficult at first, but you keep just trying, you'll figure it out eventually. And by the way, the Weimark group did something that got me really kind of upset, and that's they went ahead and insulted me, or at least asking me. Now you have the Weimark local connected to Bradmeister. Now, instead of it being private, it's open. Also, it actually has some physical effects on the system. I'm kind of mad at some people, so. Oh well, that's just my opinion. Back to you, Dick, K2IW, K2J.
Radio Raceman.
Sounds like Mike's got his question reasonably answered for now, but he can come back and ask more later if he wants. Nick, you're next, N2HVR. And how those electrons and ozone clock treating you tonight? You got it, Nick.
Good evening, Dick. This is N2HVR, and yeah, an ozone clock. I got a quick question, so like a yes or no. I've been playing with 2 meter AM, and I have on my Yaesu rig, I can only put out 20 watts. But my question is this. I have a Mirage amplifier that I've used in the past for it's it has a mode button, FM, and sideband, and you drive it with an HT. You can drive it with 5 watts, and you can put out about maybe 45 watts with 5 watts in. That's it's made for FM and sideband. My question is, if I were to use my base rig and use a 5-watt drive on 2 meter AM, would the amplifier work if I sent an AM signal, an amplitude modulation signal, into this Mirage amplifier? Back to net.
We're in an FMD mode, and it will operate Class AB.
I think there's sort of a yes and a no to that, Nick. The Mirage-type amplifiers are sort of set up for Class C. In other words, they're not very linear. They're not biased. A linear amplifier that would reproduce an AM modulated signal correctly draws, you could say, 50% of its normal current, 50% of its maximum current, just in standby service. It's biased that way. And then the signal itself brings it up and down from that point. Whereas a FM amplifier, which is what the Mirage really is, when you first turn it on without any drive, it draws no current. So it's really running Class B or Class C, so to speak. As such, you put an AM signal through there, it will be heavily distorted. People will probably understand it.
Let me correct you.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Most Mirage amplifiers have a switch on it that actually changes the bias on the transistor. It's usually push-pull. You put it in the SSB mode. It's really close to Class AB. It's not perfect AB, but it's you can stick AM in there without this. Put it in the FM mode, and people aren't going to like listening to it.
So I think you're saying in the SSB mode, it'll do a medium good job of reproducing an amplitude modulated signal. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
That is correct. I mean, think about it. A single sideband is AM without the lower sideband or the upper sideband, depending upon what you're doing.
So it looks like the modern-day Mirage amplifiers that do have that switch, where they've got both the sideband mode and the CW mode, looks like you've got a solution. I believe the very early versions of the Mirage amplifiers didn't have that switch. Isn't that true, Eric?
Yeah, it's a very old one. That was a long time ago, but they all have an SSB switch on them. At least most of them do. I mean, I can look it up and tell you which ones don't, but I don't think there are any that don't anymore.
I think I've got one. So, back to you, Nick. N2HVR, KQRIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beeps.
All right, Eric and Dick. Okay, yeah, this Mirage amp is fairly modern. It's not that old. It's a Mirage B34G, and it does have a mode switch for sideband and FM. I only used to use it for FM when I used to work satellites using an HT, and, you know, I would 5 watts in and about 45 watts out. My question, okay, so if I leave it in sideband and send an AM signal through it, will it take that 5 watt drive and will that it will it increase the wattage to, like, you know, what it's made for, like an FM would be 5 watts in, 45 watts out. Will it do the same if I send an AM signal in with the mode switch on sideband? Would I still get the same amplification back to net?
If you put it in sideband, you're actually winding up reducing the gain of the amplifier.
6DBZ, I give a good answer. If the amplifier is good for 40 watts peak envelope power, that's all you can get in the AM mode, which really would be an average power in the AM mode of, let me think, I think it's 10 watts. There's a 4-to-1 ratio between the average power of AM and the peak envelope power. So you'd like to believe that because in the FM mode you can go to 40 watts, you'd like to believe that in the AM mode, before you speak into the mic, you're going to see 40 watts coming out, and you're going to continue seeing 40 watts. Well, yeah, amplitude modulation, the peak envelope power is 4 times higher than the carrier power, if you know what I mean. To be linear, you'd have to back off the drive quite a bit. I wonder if that makes a little bit more sense, Nick. N2HVR, KQRIW.
6DPZ with a comment.
Okay, QSL. I just was, my big concern.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I just didn't want to damage my base. I don't really care too much about the amplifier. I've had it for years. It's not a very expensive item. But the base station that I would be using it through is. So as long as it doesn't affect my base station, I'm okay. Back to that, and thank you for your input.
DPZ with a comment. I think you're not going to damage the amplifier, but if you gave it an amount of drive so that the carrier gave you, say, 40 watts of output, it has no more up to go, if you know what I mean, to really produce AM. You'd have to back off the drive quite a bit, so people would understand it, but it would be pretty heavily distorted. But I don't think it's going to damage anything, just as long as you don't exceed the maximum input drive power that can damage the input stage of the amplifier, which you're probably not likely to do. I wonder if you have any further comments on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah. KE2RIW, KE2EJ. The input transistors in most of the large amps are pretty rugged. If it's intended to work with a, you know, 5-watt input, you usually can hit it with 10 without a problem. But actually, when they rebias it, you still have that same 12 volts on the collector, the output transistor. And you're correct in terms of it being a 4-to-1 ratio, but also the output transistors exhibit a little bit less gain as you move the bias point up.
I think we could say that a Mirage amplifier in the sideband mode is more linear than in the CW, than the FM mode, but still, by normal standards, it's not a very linear amplifier. My guess is, if you did a two-tone test, you'd probably see intermodulation distortion products that are relatively high. Now, very few of us.
Not that bad, Dick.
Really? Sounds like you've done the test. Tell me what you saw. Many solid-state amplifiers, as they reach the maximum power output, 40 watts, they're already down 1.5 dB of compression, I think. Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, for years, I've always used analog transponders on the satellite. And you know damn well that if you run into any kind of clipping, you're going to hear it right away, come right back at you. The audio sounds pretty darn good. And whether you're operating a sideband or AM, you're actually using more, how do I say this? You're doing sideband, you're looking at from, say, zero to whatever the peak is, and when you're doing AM, you're going from a minus peak to a positive peak. So that area of gain, you actually have to reduce the drive a little bit in the AM mode a little bit. It's a whole chunk, as opposed to sideband. But it is still very linear, as long as you don't overdrive it.
If the amplifier had 40 watts of peak envelope power output capability, and you properly set it up for AM, before you speak into the microphone, I think you would see a little more than 10 watts of output. Isn't that approximately right, Eric?
I would guess that's right. I always use a 120-watt amplifier, and I was always reducing the drive anyway, so I would transpond it. But, yeah, I would think that's about right, because the carrier level is going to be 1/4 what it would be for the same input at FM, so calculate that out.
If you're watching your watt meter as you speak into the microphone of an AM transmitter, you'll see the average power output increase. Over to you on this one now, Nick. Into HVR, HURIW, and the TechNet.
All right, Dick, Eric, thank you. No, I don't really have much else. I just had a few concerns. I mean, the amplifier is pretty rugged. I've used it for years. It works great. Like I said, I was more concerned. See, my base station will put out 20 watts on 2 meters. But what I would like to do is use the base station just to drive the amplifier and see if I could get maybe 30 or 40 watts and increase, you know, my power output on AM. And that was about it. So you've answered my questions. I just did not want to damage either my base station or either the amplifier, but especially the base station. All right, back to net. Thank you so much. This is N2HVR. Back to net.
Run that by again. I think you said the base station is capable of giving you 30 watts of maybe both AM and sideband, or maybe just a CW and FM. I'm not sure which. On 2 meters, I think you said. And then you want to know, is this 40-watt amplifier worth using? If your base station can put out 30 watts of what it calls AM, then I think the amplifier is not going to gain you anything, if I understand that correctly. I'll back to you on that one, Nick.
The base station actually puts out 20 watts. And with 20 watts, I'm marginal on AM for what I want to do. So I was thinking I would turn down, I can adjust the output on, instead of 20 watts, to 5 watts, which would be an FM. I would use 5 watts to drive the amplifier and get 40, 45 watts. So I'm saying if I turn down the drive on the base to 5 watts and then go through the amplifier, will I still get, you know, 40 watts out? But if I'm not going to get any improvement, I already have 20 watts on the base station without using the Mirage amplifier through just barefoot through the base station rig.
When you're in the AM mode, are you telling me the base station rig, before you speak into the microphone, reads 20 watts? And if so, 4 times that is, that in theory is 80 watts peak envelope power output on that amplifier. If it really is 20 watts, properly set up for AM. In which case, I think the amplifier, capable of 40 watts peak envelope power, is not going to gain you anything. It's worth a try, but I don't think you're going to come out ahead. You see what I'm saying on this one, Nick? Go ahead.
No, what I mean is the base station can be adjusted up to 20 watts. So it has an output
from 5 to 20 watts AM 2 meters. That's it. So, you know, I'm saying the most I can get on 2 meters is 20 watts. So I was thinking, you know, if I just turn the drive down to 5 watts, pump it through the amplifier, in FM mode, 5 watts would give me 40. So 5 watts in AM, would that still give me 40? That was, I just wanted to get a little bit more power on AM because I'm limited to only 20 watts through barefoot through my base station.
When your base station is in the AM mode, putting out 20 watts, is that the recommended way to set up AM modulation? If so, 20 watts you'd see on the watt meter before you speak into the microphone. If it's set up correctly, when you speak into the microphone, if you were looking with an oscilloscope, you would see 80 watts of peak envelope power. If it was truly linear, 20 watts of carrier power output in the AM mode. And so, now, it's possible that the way you're using it, you're getting 20 watts indicated, but maybe it's not capable in the AM mode, the base station, of going to 80 watts peak envelope power. There's a 4-to-1 ratio between no speech carrier power with AM and 4 times that amount of power with peak envelope power of AM if it's set up to be thoroughly linear. You see what I'm saying on this one, Nick? Go ahead. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I don't know that because I don't have, I mean, I have a watt meter that I could use. It's not that accurate, but what I'm just saying is I just tune to AM, and in AM I can adjust the wattage on the Yaesu rig to 20 watts. I don't actually know exactly what it's putting out. I'm just saying I'm setting the wattage for 20, which is the most amount of power on AM for 2 meters that the rig will put, which says it puts out. I don't know actually what's coming out of the rig. I'm assuming it's 20 watts, but that's all I could. I really don't know anything. I don't have the test equipment to confirm or deny all that.
When you're setting the base station rig for 20 watts of output, is that the recommended setting in the owner's manual? Back to you on that one, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, you go to 2 meters, you switch. I have 2 meters FM, sideband, whatever. It's a multi-mode rig. It covers HF, 2 meters, 440. And I just put it on 2 meters, I set the frequency, switch the mode to AM, and then I can adjust the output power from 5 to 20 watts. That's what I do. I don't know anything else. I'm not sure where you're going with this.
What's the model number of the radio? I'll tell you what's actually coming out of it. By the way, most ACF radios, when you go to CW and set it for 100 watts, you set it for AM, you only get the 20 watts out.
All right. It's the Yaesu FT991A.
A second, I'll look it up.
Yeah, the fact that you can twist the drive control in the AM mode and get 20 watts of output, the fact that you can do that doesn't necessarily mean it's the recommended way of using it for thoroughly linear service AM modulation because of this 4-to-1 ratio characteristic that many of us forget about. Let's see what Eric finds out on this one. While Eric is looking that one up, we're going to go on to Mark, and then we'll jump back on this one. Mark, W2MST, K2LIW, you got it, Mark.
Thanks, Dick. I'm on the net right now because I belong to a radio-controlled flying club that has been recently experiencing interference that has been causing planes to go down. We're trying to figure out where the interference is coming from, what it's being caused by, and how to resolve it. So I'm on the net tonight to find out if there's any Limemark members or member that has the ability to help this radio club out in preventing any more crashes.
Yeah, these modern digitally controlled, many individual codes, so to speak, where we don't have the frequency flags we used to have in the old days. The modern-day radio controlled radios are pretty good. But the fact that you guys are running into this problem suggests that some very strong local services are giving you grief. I know that some of the clubs used to have somebody show up with a spectrum analyzer where he could monitor the frequency to find out what other services are nearby and what's going on. So, and you guys in the sound of our voice, from Mark and mine and everybody else, who are good at radio-controlled model aircraft, do any of you guys have the equipment? Maybe even the service monitor could give you a pretty good indication. So that you could monitor the frequency to find out what's going on. Give me a call at us right now, K2IW and the TechNet.
WB2CSE.
WB2CSE, go right ahead. Start with his name, I should know you.
Yeah, hi, yes, it's Steve. Just curious, where are they flying? I know there's a place down by Cedar Creek Park. And I know there's something up on the North Shore, the Syosset area. So getting an idea of where it is may be a good start.
Go right ahead, Mark.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We fly at Cedar Creek. And interestingly enough, it doesn't get affected with every radio that we use. It seems like it's the 2.4 gigahertz radio. And it doesn't happen all the time. It's intermittent. And it seems to happen in one area of the field where there's a cell tower. We thought the cell tower was causing the problem. We had some of the cell tower companies come and inspect it, and they can't seem to find the problem. So they're not sure it's a cell tower-related issue or some other kind of interference. It's right near Cedar Creek Water Pollution Treatment Plant, and we're thinking that maybe that's putting out some kind of signal and noise. But the bottom line is we're not sure, and we're losing very expensive planes in the woods. And it's a real issue.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's so much stuff up in that area, and the cell stuff is, I believe, below or above that. But unfortunately, you do have cordless phones. You have data from people's Wi-Fi coming out of there, and there's an assorted other stuff that it could be. And there's a lot of houses in the area.
Almost every receiver, like the receiver in your aircraft, has a certain spur-free dynamic range. Because you're using 2.4 gigs for the radio control, and because one of the nearby frequencies for cell phone is the 2.4 gig band, as the aircraft flies close to that cell site, eventually your input signal on the adjacent 2.4 gig frequency is strong enough to overload the front end, create some nonlinearity, intermodulation distortion, and so on. So flying close to that cell tower, I think, is not recommended. As inconvenient as that is, you guys may have to avoid that particular piece of real estate, as I see it, Mark. That's a guess on my part. W2MST, K2IW, and TechNet. Drag your feet in case other people want to add to this.
I'm going to sneak out of here. I just got off. WB2ZSE.
Guess nobody has comments right now. Well, what we were hoping to accomplish, and I was asked to go on to the net. I used to be a Limewatch member years ago. Haven't been able to get back into it yet, but the people in the club were hoping that there might be somebody that has spectrum analyzers or monitors and directional finding equipment that could at least point us in the direction of where the interference is coming from so that we can maybe figure out where it's coming from and how to resolve it. We're not positive it's coming from cell towers. It seems like it only happens when the planes are flying at a certain altitude, at a certain time, which is unpredictable, and in proximity of the cell tower. But there's a lot of other stuff. There's the, like I said, the water treatment plant that's right there that, you know, might be giving off stuff that we're not aware of. And that's what I was hoping to reach out for, to help locate and figure out where the interference is coming from.
WHYY, I got a question for Dick directly related to this.
Yeah, I'm about to pass it over to Joe. But one of the people you want to seek out, Mark, is Andy, WA2CDO, WA2 Commercial Driver's License, CDL. He is very well equipped with spectrum analyzers, surface monitors, and so on. And if you could talk him into coming to the field with his portable battery-operated service monitor and let him monitor that frequency. Oh, wait a minute now. Does the service monitor go to 2.4 gigs? Maybe Joe can give me some information on that. W-H-R-Y-Y, you've got it, Joe. K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
No, most what you call a standard service monitor goes up to 1 gig, and that's pretty much about it. My comment was going to be, there are service providers in that part of the band. It's called a PCS band. It may not be coming from 2.4 gig by itself, because the power generated 2.4 gig, even from Wi-Fi hotspots and so forth, is rather low in power level. But some of the PCS providers, and especially the stuff in the new band for Metro PCS, I believe they use about 1750 megahertz on their uplink for this output, and they use 2150 to 2200 megahertz on their output for the base station or the downlink. So that may be the first place you want to look for, because the other people like Sprint are running about 1960, 1965, 1970 output, and T-Mobile is much lower than that, like 1930 to 1950 output in their base station. So we may want to look with a spectrum analyzer first. It may not be within the band that's killing you. And that was my question, Dick. How much can these receivers tolerate out of band energy before they just go screwy?
Now, it would take a pretty complicated test procedure in order to find out what is the spur free dynamic range. If a 2100 megacycle signal gets stronger and stronger, at some point the receiver on the aircraft will start behaving improperly. Now, even if we had, here's a question for you, Joe, and it's a tough one. We had a good spectrum analyzer scanning the whole frequency region, 1700 to 2400. Under normal circumstances, when you're near a cell site, you'll see signals popping up and going back down continuously as people are making and breaking calls. And now to correlate that signal popping up and going down versus an aircraft behaving incorrectly, to try to correlate that is a difficult problem. And I'm not quite sure how you could do it. So even if you had, on the field, a real good spectrum analyzer showing that whole frequency region, knowing which signal is giving us the grief, not going to be easy. The B2RYY, got any suggestions? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Good to you.
Semi Joe. Eric, go ahead.
No, just to let you know, Sprint has 1900, 2500, T-Mobile 1900, 1700, and they also have, I believe they have a little bit of 2100. The rest of the guys are pretty much 1900 and 1700, and then, of course, lower 700 and so on and so forth. But, yeah, the front ends of most of the chips that you use for Wi-Fi, really, if they're well-designed, there'll be some kind of helical resonator in the front. But generally, that's not the case. They go cheap and just use what the chip is doing. The chip has its front end. It's got its mixer. And don't forget, you're dealing with spread spectrum, too, so it's got to be pretty fat. K2RW, K2EJ.
Yeah, that radio control receiver doesn't have a great big filter. Have you ever seen a radio control receiver on an aircraft? It's a very compact thing. They make them light and small so that they can fit in all the corners of various kinds of aircraft. So there's not a great brick wall front-end filter. So that whole frequency region, if it's strong enough, could give them grief, I think. Now, assuming you had your best spectrum analyzer sitting on that field and you're watching all these signals up that frequency region popping up and down and try to correlate them to an aircraft behaving improperly, I think that's going to be a very difficult analysis. Got any suggestions on that one, Eric, before we go over to Joe? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, for me, I'd probably tap into the chip and see what's actually going on, but I've got a spectrum analyzer going on. You really got to deal with it in the receiver if you really want to know the truth, because, you know, you're going to see energy all over the place. I don't care what frequency you're looking at. If you're anywhere near the cell phone frequency, you're going to be seeing stuff. So What we really need to do is take that particular receiver, put it on the bench, and do a couple tests and find out how sensitive it is, you know. At what point does the IP3 just fall apart?
Putting it on the bench brings you halfway home, but still, when the aircraft is, let's say, a quarter of a mile away from you, you know how many watts you're transmitting with the handheld transmitter, radio control transmitter. You therefore can calculate roughly how strong is the signal getting to the little whip antenna that's on the aircraft. So that's the input signal. And you know how strong are the cell site signals, and depending on how close you are to the cell site, you can calculate how strong that signal is going to be going into the receiver. So on the bench, to put in the right signal strength at, say, 1700, you put in a weak enough signal for the 2400 with the radio control signal on it. That's a good trick right there. I mean, the transmitter is in the room with you. How do you knock it down to minus 80 dBm, if you know what I mean, to find out if it has been desensitized? So to do that test of dynamic range, receiver sensitivity, blocking, and whatever, on the bench, the words roll off the tongue easily. To really do it is not quite as easy as it sounds. You might end up putting that transmitter in a shielded compartment in order to weaken the signal enough to find out whether or not it has become desensitized by a strong local signal. You see what I'm saying here, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. It'd be awful nice if the manufacturer would give you that information, but I guarantee they do not. You got it, Eric.
I'm just thinking of something else. Do these receivers use high side or low side ejection? Because that might have a factor on, you know, getting near some sort of out-of-band energy if you're actually getting an image, because the what's called the AWS band, I think, for what the new cellular carrier, Metro PCS, they use CDMA technology, but they use 1750 going in, and like I said, 2150 to 2200 going out. But
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because something just sneaking through because it's so incredibly powerful. I don't know the construction of these receivers, which way they, you know, run the LO inside these things, whether it's high side ejection or low side. That might have a significant factor in what you can get near, what you can't get near.
Yeah, Joe, you're assuming that the receiver is a super heterodyne. It might be a zero IF system. I wonder if we know that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, most of the chips are actually a zero IF system. Some of them are not. The first thing I do is find out what chip they're using and then look at the spec sheet on it to begin with. I'm spoiled. I've got the VNA. I've got a couple of signal generators that actually will make streams. So that's why I think that way. Yes, it's difficult. There's no question about it. Especially since it's hopping all over the place. So you're not going to get the same results on it at each frequency.
Got a comment.
Go ahead. I've got a comment. Who are you?
It's Mark, W2MSC. Just to add, I don't know if this is important to the understanding of the problem, but this problem just all of a sudden happened. For many, 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 many years, we've been flying with no issues whatsoever, and it seems like whatever caused the problem has just recently occurred. So it's got to be something that, you know, that we could track down, something that's new and something that we should be able to find if we had some kind of directional, direction-finding equipment, you know, that could find the frequency that's causing the problem, I would think.
WHSDBL Mobile, to copy me.
Another comment, Dick.
Andy, you're just the guy we want to hear. I hope you've been hearing the beginning of this conversation. Then I'll go over to Eric right after that. Mr. CST, commercial, CDL, commercial driver's license, you've got it, Andy.
I'll pick up a free on the doorstep. I've been on the road all day, and I'm in Jersey. Do me a favor, just have them call me. Tell them to look up my email. I can't stay on too long because I'm in traffic here. I'm just listening in, and I have an enriched suit that goes up to 4 gigs. It's portable, but have them call me also, okay? Can you do that? Or have them look up my email address?
Very fine, Andy. We're going to have Mark do that. look up WA2CDO and get a hold of you. You've got the right test equipment. Now, Eric, one of the things we have to worry about is which of the receivers that these radio control people are using are superhet or zero IF. If it is superhet and we can calculate the image frequency, that would give us a hint. But I'll bet you in the last couple of months there have been new services added to the cell sites. So if we know when that new service got cut in, that would be another clue. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the Texan.
Hi, KQRIW, KE2EJ. Going back to the other gentleman's question, the FT991, which actually makes 50 watts on FM, on 2 meters, it only makes a maximum carrier of 25 watts on AM, so there's your answer. So his high power is 50 watts in FM, and it's 25 watts in AM. No, wait a minute, that's HF. So it's gonna be half that. Yeah, it's gonna be 12.5 watts. You know, carrier, no modulation. You know what? Give me another minute. I'm gonna look up some front end chips and just see how they do it. But don't forget, this stuff is frequency hopping. It's going all over the place. Also, 5G is beginning to come into play in some places. Like I know I was talking to the T-Mobile guys. They're not ready yet to do it here. But they have added 700 in places, and they're also doing some stuff at 1900. And let me let it drop for a second because I've got an interesting story to tell you. At the TV station, not only do I have the TV transmitting, but I also have a T-Mobile site. And their second harmonic at 1900, they're running about 80 watts, I think. Actually wipes out one of my C-band transponders that are coming down that we use. We had to move to a different dish on a different satellite just to get away from their antennas, and don't forget they're also beamforming all their antennas. So give me a minute, I gotta look up a couple of tips. KQRIW, KQRJ.
I'm going to guess that a significant number of the radio controlled receivers are a zero IF system. That's all you need to demodulate that frequency hopping signal, direct spread spectrum frequency hopping. And the chip can do that easily. You don't have to have all these IF cans and local oscillators and mixers and everything else that can give you a lot of grief. So to make the receiver nice and simple, when we look up those chips, I'll bet you a lot of them are zero IF. The receiver is probably somewhat similar to the kind of receiver you have in a RFID interrogator. And that makes life simpler as far as calculating images are concerned. But it doesn't make life simpler when it comes to total dynamic range. How strong can an adjacent frequency signal be when you're listening to a weak on-channel frequency from the actual radio control transmitter? And where does that overload take place? For the time being, of all those things that you are talking about nearby to that flying site, Mark, I suspect that cell site and all the services that are adding to it is by far the highest probability of the thing that's giving you the grief. And I think you guys are going to have to make sure you don't fly in that corner of the field, as inconvenient as that might be. Anybody who want to add anything to all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Just another comment. This is Mark again. Apparently, this only happens with one particular brand transmitter, one called a Futaba. And there's a certain protocol, which is way beyond my understanding, called the FAST protocol or something like that, that seems to be what is susceptible to this problem. Futaba has conceded that they do have a problem with this FAST system, some transmitters, and that you just shouldn't use them in the area where there's a problem. So I don't know if that helps clue anybody in on what the problem might be, but I just think I'd throw that out there.
I think that's very helpful. Are you saying, Mark, that everybody not using Futaba has not had the problem? Is that what you're saying, Mark? Go ahead.
I make a suggestion. It may sound very simple, but I'd like to make a suggestion.
Yeah, let me get Mark to answer that question first. Go ahead, Mark. Does everybody not using Futaba has essentially never had this crashing problem?
That's correct. It seems to be limited to Futaba and to certain Futaba radios incorporating this system that I described, the FOT system, again, which I don't understand.
You've got it done. All right, White.
Got an answer for you.
Let me make the comment first, because this may be a way of getting a handle on this. Why don't you have, instead of just putting the plane up in the air and flying it, why don't you have somebody walk with the plane in their hands and have somebody control things like the elevator and rudder and continuously do that and see if you lose controllability. Somebody physically walks near one of these cell towers. And just, that would probably give you a handle, because I understand these things use, the base stations are using high gain antennas, 10, 12 dB of gain antennas, so they have a rather sharp kind of pattern to the horizon. But I think if you get nearer, you're going to have some fingers that are coming lower towards the ground. You might be able to prove out what you're talking about as far as what you think is the interference issue possibly. So yeah, I would try that first. At least you'll crash the plane that way.
That is a nice test, particularly with handy talkie. The guy's got the aircraft in his hand. He's walking it near the cell site. By the handy talkie, he's telling his buddy to move the elevator and rudder right now, and hey, it's working pretty well. There's going to be enough distance between the transmitter, the radio control transmitter, and the aircraft walking near the cell tower that you're out of audio communication range. It's got to be done with handy talkies, I think. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, I just looked at a couple of Texas Instrument chips and a Qualcomm chip, and they're direct conversion. They go directly to INQ, and then it goes away from there, so there's not much of an RF system. And the two basic modes that you operate, one is ODFM, and the other is the direct sequence spread spectrum, so... I probably would be one wanting to go ODFM for that kind of an application, but it depends upon the... It's probably going to change according to the bit rate, you know, its received sensitivity. As the signal gets weaker, it's probably going to switch back over to direct sequence, because you get a better chance of maintaining communication like that. So it's more complicated than it seems.
Yeah, the good news about a zero IF system is it has a lot of the characteristics of a synchronous demodulator. Unless the signal of interest is right on frequency, you get a very little response out of it until you get a whopping big signal. So a zero IF system, direct conversion, is amazingly immune to strong local signals because of this characteristic like a synchronous demodulator. That's a lot simpler than a super heterodyne system. The nice thing about a super heterodyne system is that it, in theory, can be very selective. Bad news is that there's all kinds of M by N products, you know, 2x3 products, second harmonic of the LO or the third harmonic of the RF, creating a phony signal in the IF system, and images versus real and so on, and a lot more electronics required. In the chips that you've been looking up, Eric, is the recommended filter in the front end what you and I would call a robust filter? I doubt it. I suspect it's a very simple LC filter is the recommended use with that chip. KE2EJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm looking that up right now, so give me another second. I'll tell you what they have to say about it.
Just another comment. It appears that the problem only shows its ugly head at certain altitudes. So I don't know that test on the ground will actually simulate the problems that we're having.
Yeah, that could definitely be a problem, Mark, because the actual antenna pattern from that cell site, if you could see it, they usually use Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, in other words, what do they call it now? In other words, there's three sectors. There's a set of antennas covering each 120-degree sector, and the antennas are set up to have a pancake pattern, a signal that's aimed at the horizon. If the cell tower itself is, let me pick a number, 80 foot tall, and it's got an antenna with a very narrow elevation pattern aimed at the horizon, until your aircraft is in the vicinity of 80 feet of altitude, it's not in that beam. And on the ground, you're under the umbrella, so to speak, and you're going to get a misdetection of what we're looking for. But you guys have done an awful lot already when you found out that a particular brand, Futaba, is more vulnerable. That's a very valuable piece of information. And when you look at the schematic diagrams and the chips being used by Futaba and the methods of modulation and demodulation, I think that's going to give you some further clues. KQIW listening. You guys wait for the beeps.
I got an answer for you, Dick.
Okay, wait for the beeps, and you got it, Eric.
This is for a Texas Instruments chip. It's a dual-band Wi-Fi. It can be used for Bluetooth and Bluetooth low energy. The antenna actually passes through a 1.3 nanohenry choke in parallel with the antenna to ground. And it passes through a one pop capacitor to another choke that's, what is it? It's 0.4 nanohenries to ground. Okay, it's 2.2 nanohenries. That's for 2.4 gigs. It's 2.2 nanohenries and 1.3 nanohenries. And on the second receiver antenna, which is 5 gigs, that's 1.8 nanohenries, 2.2 nanohenries. It goes right into the front end. That's it. Nothing else.
So that front end filter is passing a very wide chunk of frequencies with probably a Gaussian-shaped filter, and for all we know, it's a couple hundred megacycles wide, so to speak. Synchronous demodulation characteristic of a zero IF system is the only thing that's protecting you. And what's different about what Futaba is using is Futaba using a much older chip, a very different design. There's some clues there. Anybody with any further comments, give me a call. It's K2RIW. Yeah, as you find out what Futaba is doing that's different from what your other receivers are doing, that's going to give you a clue. But for the time being, I guess you got to make sure you don't fly a Futaba airplane, Futaba receiver, transmitter, you know, RC system. And I think you said that when you guys talked to Futaba, they admitted there's a problem. And I'm amazed that Futaba admitted that, but Futaba probably has no great suggestion, because maybe they're entrenched in that particular design, and to make a change at this late stage maybe not be easy for them. So tell me what Futaba said, Mark. Go ahead.
I didn't speak with them directly. One of the other people in the club did. And from what I understand, they basically acknowledged the fact that there's a problem with this specific protocol, which, again, I think they called it the FAST protocol. I think they're going to be changing it, newer versions, but transmitters that have this FAST protocol are subject to this kind of interference. And basically, they suggested that they shouldn't use any of the Futaba radios that have this particular kind of technology.
Does Futaba make more than one model? Some do have this FAST, and some models do not. And have, by the same token, have any of you RC flyers flew another model number of Futaba that didn't have the problem? Over to you, Mark.
Yes, there are other models that Futaba makes, and they're problem-free. They don't have any issues with those. It's just this particular version that has the problem. But, again, you know, it never was a problem until recently, so there's something that just came on board creating noise that's playing havoc with the field. And we're hoping to find somebody that's got, you know, radio equipment that can detect the signal and help us locate where it's coming from so that we can get it resolved.
I'm going to make a guess on this one, Mark. That new service that has come along that's giving you grief, it's a long shot that there's something improper with that service. I'll bet you that service is, let me pick a number, 1700 megacycles, pretty strong signal, with some crazy kind of modulation that the new service is using. And you try to talk them into stop using that service, not a chance. The chances of them putting out a strong amount of second harmonic that's giving you the grief, there's a slim chance of that, but that's kind of doubtful. I think you're going to have to live with this new service. You're going to have to accept the fact that the Futaba FAST system is vulnerable and stop using it, because I think your chances of stopping that new service that's giving you the grief to make them go away where they've got a big investment in dollars. I think that's a long shot. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Mark. K2RIW in the tech man.
A2J with a comment.
You got it, Eric.
No, let's make an assumption that the interfering system